Donald Davidson, celebrating 40 years as the host of the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry. Skilled on principle, union by choice. On 1070, The Fan.
Welcome to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, where today we'll recap the activity, and we're done. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan with Donald Davidson. I'm Kevin Lee. We did nothing of substance here today. Got to visit with some people, a lot of drivers wandering through the media center today without much to do, hanging out in the garage, but not a lap was turned today by a race car. And we'll try again tomorrow morning. Rain all day today. It still rains after the 6 o'clock hour. We'll hope for better weather conditions tomorrow as we lead up to the pole. Next week, Tom Carnegie Day, and 22 will be qualified. Then we'll have the Fast 9 shootout at 4:30. 11 more get in the field with bumping as well on Sunday as we head towards the May 29th, 100th anniversary of the Indianapolis 500. We have open phone lines at 317-239-1070. 317-239-1070. Tomorrow, noon to 6 is when the track will be open and the gates will open at 9 a.m. Let's go ahead and get right into it. We have people waiting for us, and we're going to start with Blaine in Greenwood. Blaine, go ahead. You're on the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson.
Hey, guys. Good evening.
Good evening.
Just went into the museum today to get out of the rain, Donald.
Yeah.
And I saw that white piano sitting in there. And why is that piano there?
Okay, the piano was Mary George like that. That piano took part in the, was it the 1984 Olympic Games in Los Angeles? Whenever
yes,
the
they
Olympic
were.
Games was,
yeah,
was in L.A., that was the closing ceremony, and I think they had a bunch of black grand pianos and the one white grand piano, and how Mary George came to want to purchase it, I have no idea, but it's been in the museum probably since shortly after that, and they use it for, normally it's roped off, but they do actually use that if they have after-hours entertainment. Then the fellow doesn't need to bring a piano because they've already got one. But I know it does get, a lot of people do second takes, so they'll say, what year did the piano run in the 500? We don't remember that one.
Thank you for the call, Blaine.
Thank you.
239-1070 is the number, and Steve is up next on 1070 The Fan. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Donald.
Hi, Steve.
In the 1939 race, Floyd Roberts qualified well back in the field, although he had a very mm-hmm. good speed.
Mm-hmm.
And the best I can tell at the time of his accident, he was actually running a lap behind those that were also
yeah.
involved in the wreck. I wondered if you could just talk about a little bit of what all went wrong for him that year.
Well, I don't know. Everything went well in 38. He was on the pole and won the race. He wasn't the fastest qualifier. I think he ended up being the third fastest qualifier, but he was on the pole, won the race, and then the next year just seemed to have a struggle. A second car was built by the same builder that built the 38 winner, Curly Wetteroth, and that car actually was owned jointly by Lou Moore and Floyd Roberts. And they spent quite a bit of time with that one. And, in fact, Floyd Roberts drove that one in practice. And then they had Frank Warren drive it in the race. Whatever the problems were with Roberts, I don't know. But I think it was the second weekend qualification run. And I don't know that he ever got into the top 10. He just seemed to have a bit of a struggle and was in the wrong place at the wrong time or the wrong place at the right time. When he came across the accident where Bob Swanson had flipped a car, he'd just taken it over from Ralph Hepburn. It's not the car that he relieved Hepburn in 2 years before when they finished second, but he'd only been in it a couple of laps and spun coming off the second turn and got thrown out onto the track, and then Chet Miller swerved to avoid him. Floyd Roberts comes on the scene. I've seen film, but it's been quite a while. And he sort of turns to the right, goes through just the wooden picket fence, which would do nothing to stop you. And the car goes bouncing, but it never gets upside down. And then you see the driver, Bob Swanson, is picked up. Not on a stretcher, but just a couple of people just pick him up and haul him off. And I thought, golly, if he wasn't hurt before, he's hurt now. And when you think, you see what happened to Bob Swanson, you see Chet Miller flipping to the inside, they were both hospitalized, and you think, well, the other one didn't look to be that bad, and that was the one that was the fatality. So it's just rather a strange thing. And again, I don't believe that he ever, I don't think he had a 10-lap segment where he was in the top 10.
Okay. Thank you, Steve. 239-1070 is our telephone number. Let's try Andy next in Muncie, Indiana. Hello, Andy. You're up with Donald Davidson.
Hi, Andy.
Yes, Roger Ward. I believe he was one of the most underrated drivers, superstars in the history of the race. Like from 1959 to 64, was he ever out of the top four or five?
Not out of the top four. From 59 to 64, he was first, second, third, first, fourth, second. So I think that's two firsts, two seconds, a third, and a fourth. Yeah, it was a phenomenal record. And the first part of his career at the Speedway was not remarkable at all. In fact, he'd only had one eighth-place finish prior to that, from 51 through 58. He had a couple of good runs. In 58, he ran second for a while and then dropped out at 93 laps. I think we did Roger Ward. We did a bit on him the other night. Mm-hmm. But did you have a particular comment about him?
His last year was 66.
Yes, it was.
And he was a teammate to Stuart Hill.
Correct.
He had...
That is correct. They had three Lolas, and I think Roger Ward actually was the first person hired onto that team when John Meekham decided that he wanted to go Indianapolis 500 or USAC Championship Racing. They formed a team in the summer of 65, and Ward had left leader cards. He'd missed the show at Indianapolis, which was absolutely stunning. After the record that we just mentioned, going up through to second in 64, then in 65 with a new car, they ended up missing the show, was first alternate starter. They went to Milwaukee and had a very unimpressive run there, and then Ward left. They went to Atlanta with Rutherford, and he won. And so that didn't look too good for Ward. But in the meantime, Roger was the first driver hired, as I say, by John Meekham. They purchased the car that it was a Hallebrand Shrike that Rutherford had driven in the 500, and Roger drove that at Raceway Park. And I think he may have had a couple of other runs which weren't very successful. And then in the fall, the final race at Phoenix, they had a newer Lola. And Roger ran third for a while. He didn't finish, but at least he had a good run going. And so anyway, he was to be the lead driver. And the original lineup was going to be Roger Ward, John Surtees, and Walt Hanskin. And first of all, Surtees got hurt in Canada, I think in a sports car race. And so he wasn't going to be able to... He announced that he wouldn't be ready because he had a back injury. And then they hired Jackie Stewart to replace him. Now, Jackie Stewart was the new kid on the block in Formula One. He'd run the British Grand Prix in 64 in a Lotus. There's a little trivia. He was actually Jim Clark's teammate, the British Grand Prix in 64. And I think they shared a flat at that time. But anyway, then in 65, Jackie went to BRM and won the Italian Grand Prix. It was his only victory, but he finished third in the World Championship. So he was sort of like the kid that everybody was looking at. And so he replaced Surtees. And then the final thing that happened to change in the team was that Walt Hanskin was fatally injured in April in practice runs at Le Mans. He was part of the Ford team. They went to Le Mans for the practice. It rained. It was rather like today. And the car aquaplaned, and he crashed and was fatally injured. So he had been entered for the 500. It was just before the program went to press, and so what they did, because there wasn't a replacement, they removed Hanscom's name. So if you get the 66 program, number 24, American Red Bull Special, there's no driver. And in fact, Hanscom had practiced here. He'd come to test at some time in the spring of 66. And so then that's when Graham Hill came in. Now, Surtees tells that Graham Hill came in to replace him, and that he basically, Hill won the race that Surtees should have won. Well, that's not exactly how it happened. But anyway, we're supposed to be talking about Roger Ward. For some reason, Roger Ward was given a supercharged Offenhauser engine. Not a turbocharged, but a supercharged Offie, and Stewart and Hill had the 255 normally aspirated Fords, which Ward felt that he should have. George McNulty was the chief mechanic on all three cars, and what went on here I really don't know, but Ward began to think that he wasn't getting, if not preferential treatment, that he actually was the third man on the totem pole, and he came in thinking, you know what? I've won the race twice, and I thought I was to be the lead driver, and my two teammates are foreigners that haven't run here before, other than for Hill taking a rookie test in 63. So he was a little disgruntled about that, and Roger could get disgruntled fairly easily. And so anyway, during the race, this is the thing. He came in twice, the second time for good, and he was complaining of handling problems both times. And the second time, he just got out of the car and said, look, I can't drive it. And they pushed the car back to the garages, and it was out. And there are those that say that really there wasn't any handling problems and that it was just a deterioration within the team. And Roger had several things to consider. He'd been a father twice over in recent years. He had two boys who were now in their late teens or early 20s by that time, and now he had two little children with a new wife. And then he just was so disgruntled that there was an accident. I mean, he'd avoided the 1964 accident, which took the life of Eddie Sachs and Dave McDonald. And then at the start of the 66 race, there's another crash, which he manages to get through. But I think he started to think, you know what, do I really want to do this? And so he said that he was out there running, and he said, I was mad at McNulty. I was mad at myself for several things. And he said, I started thinking about my kids, and I told myself, Roger Ward, you're too old to be doing this, because he was, I'd have to figure out what age he was. If he was 38 and 59, how old was he? He was 45, I think, or something like that.
Yeah.
So anyway, he just came in and parked. And Phil Hedback was beside himself because the Bryant Heating and Cooling sponsorship was on the car. And I remember Phil Hedback telling me that he had, as a guest, Skitch Henderson, who was the musical director for the Tonight Show back in the early to mid-60s. And so Skitch Henderson was there, and he was a Brit, actually, British by birth, and he was a sports car enthusiast, and he kind of liked the 500. So when they pushed the car away, the thinking was Ward just retired, and so apparently Skitch said, this is amazing. We're here, and we're experiencing history because we're seeing this great driver at the end of his career. And Phil Hedback said, but if he stayed out there, you know, who knows where we could finish. Well, as the race wore on, as it turns out, with all kinds of problems and Jackie Stewart leading until nine laps to go, when he stopped because the oil pressure was dropping and they didn't want to risk blowing the engine up, which the Americans would have gone ahead and done. And then Graham Hill cruises on to victory, and Roger Ward was running ahead of Graham Hill. So had Ward stayed out there, he very likely could have won his third Indianapolis 500. But then at the victory banquet, I remember this was stunning. Normally Roger would give a very eloquent acceptance speech when he was given his prize money. And I was there, and I remember it was really stunning because he came up to get 15th place prize money. And he said, well, thank you very much. Sid Collins was the MC. He said, thank you very much. He said, a long time ago, I told myself that if it stopped being fun, I'd quit. Well, yesterday, it just wasn't fun anymore, and his voice started cracking up. And a lot of people didn't know that Roger Ward was a very emotional guy, and he just started to sob and went and sat down and put his head down, and some of the other drivers came over and patted him on the shoulder. But he never did drive in the 500 again, never tried.
Wow. All right, thank you for the call, Andy. More of your questions for Donald. 239-1070 is the number. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan.
Donald Davidson, celebrating 40 years as the host of the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry. Skilled on principle, union by choice. On 1070 The Fan.
Thanks for staying with us. With Donald Davidson, I'm Kevin Lee. We are at the soggy Indianapolis Motor Speedway, where today we did not see anything happen. We'll try again tomorrow from noon until 6, getting set for qualifying this weekend. 239-1070 is the number. All of our lines are full at the moment, so when somebody finishes up, that's your cue to call in. And Mike in Vernon Hills, Illinois, joins us next. Hello, Mike.
Hi, gentlemen. How are you?
Hi, Mike.
Good. Hey, one other comment about Roger Ward. Didn't he win his last race in the spring of 66?
Yes, good point. What I was doing was talking about how dismal 65 was. Thank you for bringing that up. The first real bright spot was when he ran third for a while in the finale at Phoenix in 65, and then he dropped out. Then in the spring of 66, he finished second at Phoenix, and then the next race was Trenton, 150-mile race, and the rain fell, and I think it was like 101 laps or something like that, and Roger Ward was leading, and they called the race, so he actually finished second and first and went into the 500 leading the national championship. So thank you. I hadn't thought about that. Mike, you still there?
We got you back, Mike. Go ahead with your question.
I wonder if you could please profile George Snyder.
Oh, all right. Well, George has the distinction of driving in more 500s without posting a win. 22 starts, and where that puts him on the all-time list, it's in the top 10, but I think he probably ranks about 6th or 7th in terms of total numbers of starts, 22. And, in fact, he qualified for 23 races, but he started 22. 65 was the first, and he goes all the way through until 83 was the final. No, I'm sorry, 85 was the final. And no, it wasn't. 87 was the last start. Okay, we're there now. 65 through 87. And the only one that he didn't start was 81. He qualified for that one and then gave up his seat to Tim Richmond. And I'll come back and just say that rather than go through all of the finishes, he only made the top 10 twice. He had an 8th in 75 and an 8th in 78. And he was on the front row in 66, and his forte, I suppose, although he really didn't like doing this, his forte was that he would qualify at the very last minute. And he normally drove for Foyt. Some people say he always drove for Foyt. No, not every year. But typically, Foyt would roll a second car out, and it would come out midway through the afternoon of the final day, and that's the only practice laps he would get. And then he would make the show and then normally not necessarily last very long in the race. And in 81, I'll just do a few anecdotes here. I'm not going to do every year, but 81 was just really astounding, I think. One of the most amazing things, I think, that we've seen, because he comes to the track on the last day, and he hasn't been on the track yet. And then Foyt says, well, how do you feel? Do you feel racy? Yeah, you know. So anyway, they get the car out, and it was probably around, I don't know, 2:30, I think, when the car was towed back with the tractor. And typical George Snyder expression, expressionless. He always had the same look on his face most of the time. The weather was moving in. And they just needed to get a few practice laps, but because the weather was moving in and they thought, hey, it may rain out the rest of the day, everybody pushes in line. So they pushed the car in line, and that was the last year for the three warm-ups rather than the two. So Snyder's coming towards the front of the line, and the word to the officials was, in timing and scoring, Snyder's going to go out, but this is not going to be an attempt. They just figured out if we put him in line, he can get he can do three laps, two of them at speed, and then you simply don't take the green, and you got a couple of free practice laps. Because the track's not available. We need to practice, but the only way we can get out there is to pretend we're going to do a qualifying run. So then the plan was that he would do the laps, come in, get on the end of the line, and if necessary, come through again. So to everyone's amazement, at the end of the third lap, the green flag comes out. And evidently his previous hot lap was fast enough, and they timed him coming off of turn four on the third lap, and it was good enough, so they said, hey, give him the green. So he goes ahead, does the four laps, and qualified. Now, what was truly remarkable about that, there were several things that were truly remarkable about it. He, not only had he not driven that car, he hadn't driven any car during the month, and more than that, he had been injured the previous year, I think at DuQuoin. But it was sometime in September, he got injured. He'd been on the injured list for a while, and he had not raced in anything. And he gets in the cockpit of this car, and the first time they fire the engine up on a Snyder-driven car for like 6 or 7 months, it's to go out onto the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and he goes from zero to doing, you know, 220 miles an hour or whatever it was at the time, and he goes ahead and qualifies. It was just an extraordinary accomplishment. Well, it went for naught because Tim Richmond got bumped in another car, and his sponsors came to Foyt with an opportunity to put Richmond in the car for financial consideration. So Foyt said, well, it's okay with me, but you'll have to talk to George. He qualified it, so it's his ride. So they went and talked to George, and I think they paid him $25,000 to not run.
That's good work.
So George took the deal.
Yeah.
And so anyway, Richmond started last and ran. He finished 14th. And I asked George, oh, I don't know if it was a few days, weeks later, I asked him, you know, that's the very first time you've ever been to a 500 where you weren't driving in it. And he said, yeah. And so I said, how was your day? He said, well, I really didn't know what to do with myself. He said, I come to the track, I go into the garage, but I didn't have to put a uniform on. And I've never done that before where I didn't have to put one on. And he said, so I sort of hung around with them and helped push the car out, and then when they were getting ready to start the race, he said, I went down into the inside of turn one to watch the start. He said, I stayed there for a few laps and thought, well, there's nothing much going on here. So he said, I just went back to the garage. And I think he stayed on the grounds. So he said, I would never do that again.
Real quick, what kind of career outside of Indianapolis did George Snyder have? I've always heard just about his career at the 500.
Yeah, I know. Well,
was what kind of success did he
have? He had success in midgets, although he didn't pursue them a great deal. And then probably champ dirt cars were the best. He won at DuQuoin in, I think he won at DuQuoin in 71, and won he was the first USAC dirt car champion, is what they called it then. It was after they removed the championship races on dirt tracks. They removed them into a separate circuit, and 71 was the first year, and he was the champion, with McElroy second. And then he won Springfield. He won Springfield again, and I'm stuck on what year that was.
Okay.
Now, but, was it 81? I think it was 1981. And then he won a couple of sprint races, but probably championship dirt cars was where he did the best.
Thank you for the call, Mike. So 70 was the last year that dirt races were part of the regular IndyCar championship.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay, all right. Up next, we'll check in with Michael in Indianapolis. Hello, Michael. You're up with Donald Davidson.
Hi, Michael.
Hey, Kevin, Donald. How you guys doing tonight?
Okay.
Hey, Kevin, I got a thing. I sent you a message earlier, and hopefully you'll check it. But anyway, Donald, my question tonight is Jose Legarza. What's he doing these days?
Well, I think he's living in Mexico City. He came up, he was here about, what, 3 years ago? And we were hopeful that he would be one of the drivers who would come to be part of the autograph session and be part of the photograph. We were trying to assemble as many 500 drivers as we possibly can, but I don't think we've heard from Jose Lee. Several years ago, he used to regularly visit Long Beach in the spring, but he's only been here, I think he was on here on practice days, I think in it was either 95, 6, or 7, because I remember we were involved in the Channel 23 TV show in those days, and I heard one day that Jose Lee was on the grounds and visiting the suites, and we never did get to see him. And then he showed up at the museum, I think about 3 or 4 years ago, and then he came over, and I did get to see him in the tower briefly. For a while, he was he was in the ice cream business. I don't know if that's still going or not. And also, he had a program like a scholarship program to develop young Mexican drivers.
Okay, thank you for the call, Michael. 239-1070 is our number, and Ian in Bloomington is next on 1070 The Fan.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi, Ian.
On Friday evening, you mentioned you referred to a Chrysler-powered Curtis that Firestone used to test tires.
Yes.
And did that thing have wings like 2 or 3 feet wide, like aircraft wings attached to the side of the bodywork and a huge tail?
No, but I know where you're going. They had two. The first one was a Curtis. It was a 1954 Curtis, and Sam Hanks drove it, Pat O'Connor, Roger Ward, and Paul Goldsmith a little bit. And what was remarkable about this was the Firestone owned the car. They purchased it new from Curtis, and it's got thousands of miles on it. It's part of the museum collection, but it's not on display. It never ran in a race. It was just strictly their tire test car with the Chrysler engines. Well, in 59, I think it was, they got a newer car, and that's the one that Paul Goldsmith drove. That also had Chrysler engines, and I think they ran that in 59 and 60. And then this is the car, and I think probably what you may be asking is that what you may have in mind is that the car is now in the form that you mentioned with the wing on it and a couple of stabilizers and so forth. Then that is the second Firestone test car that was acquired by a drag racer named Bob Olszewski or something like that. And Art Malone drove the car because Bill France, Daytona was Daytona was now in its third year. Daytona opened in 59, and in 1961, there's an incident that I'll explain in a few moments. Bill France had put up a prize for $10,000, I think it was, for the first person to turn 180-mile-an-hour lap at Daytona. And several people had tried. Nobody'd made it. So the old Firestone test car had the stabilizer wing and some other aerodynamics were put on it, and Art Malone in 1961 actually did a 180-mile-an-hour lap. So maybe that's what you were thinking.
Okay.
Glad to learn more about it.
All right. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you, sir.
239-1070 is the number. Tyler in Greenwood is next on 1070 The Fan with Donald Davidson. Go ahead, Tyler.
It's a pleasure talking to you gentlemen tonight. This is probably going to date me, but I remember the Mickey Thompson specials that Eddie Sachs was, tragically killed in 500. I've seen, Offenhauser's Everything Come to the Track. Donald, I've seen a lot of newspapers about recent cars for Eddie. Or you thought what you're happening?
Okay, you are cutting out to the point now where I can't get the question. The one thing that you said that I did get at the beginning was that I think you were inferring that Eddie Sachs was driving for Mickey Thompson. He did not. There was an accident that took the life of Eddie Sachs, but also Dave McDonald, and it was Dave McDonald that was driving for Mickey Thompson. Eddie Sachs wasn't. Then after that, then I'm afraid I wasn't able to get the question. So I don't know if they're
try back when you got a better cell. Are you still with us? We'll try one more time in case you have. Okay,
I'll make it real quick. I've seen a lot of pictures of new car designs.
Yeah.
Do you see that happening, and what's the plan for that?
I do not do the future.
Or the
I'm
present.
Sorry. Although some people would like me to be a little more current, I will continue to live happily in the past, and that's nothing against your question, but that's come from me from a couple of angles, and I think that the consensus is that the listeners would like to hear me talk about the days gone by, and that's what I'm happy to do. I used to make predictions, but I'm not a gearhead, and if I did make predictions, it was usually on who the drivers that I thought would do well, but I stopped doing that several years ago, and so I just have no idea what's going to go into the future. As Rob Walker, great sportsman, Grand Prix car owner that wrote for Road and Track, used to say, he wrote extensively, and he used to say it's all a bit beyond me, and that's certainly true for whatever's going down on now in the technical end of racing for me.
Tyler, we're glad you called. Thank you. Donald in Richmond, Virginia is up next with Donald Davidson.
Hello, Donald.
Hi, Donald. Did Cliff Durant actually have an 8-car team in 1923 and a 5-car team in 1924?
Actually, he had a 5-car team in 23, but there were 8 cars ran as Durant specials, but he didn't own them all.
Okay.
And now I'll get myself in trouble because I haven't done this for a while. I'm a little rusty on some of these things. So let's see how the brain's doing. He had Jimmy Murphy, Eddie Hearn, and Harry Hartz drove for him, and then he drove for himself, and I think Frank Elliott would be the other one. There was a Durant special that Harlan Fengler drove that was not owned by Cliff Durant, and I think there was a couple of others. So if you look down the list, Jerry Wunderlich was the next year. But anyway, I think there was 8 Durant specials in the 23 race, and there was only 24 starters, so one-third of the field were Durant specials. But he was a very benevolent guy. In addition to owning several cars, I mean, he did sponsor other people, and sometimes he'd have his name on the car, and sometimes he did it without fanfare. Then in 24, let's see, Jimmy Murphy had gone on his own. But he drove himself both times, and also there was Jerry Wunderlich, who was part of that group. But Jerry Wunderlich didn't drive for him in 23, but he did in 24. And the best finish was Harry Hartz was second in 23, and then another Durant car that finished second that wasn't called a Durant special was the Locomobile Junior 8 special in 1925, and that was the front drive car. That was the first front drive car that came that I know we've talked about a couple of times with Jimmy Murphy, who had the concept for bringing front drive to Indianapolis because it had never been here in a 500-mile race. And Murphy was fatally injured before the car that he had ordered could be completed. And so Cliff Durant took it over and ran it as the Locomobile Junior 8 Special with Dave Lewis and Bennett Hill, and that car finished second.
All right.
A little later on, then Cliff Durant sponsored a car or underwrote a car called the Detroit Front Drive Special, which Tommy Milton drove in 27 and didn't like, and then Cliff Durant drove it in 28. That was his last start, and then I think that some of that car then became part of the Miller Hearts Special that won the race in 32, and this has come up several times. It's the car that Cliff Durant was going to drive for Harry Hearts, and then it ended up turning it over to Fred Frame, who went on to win the race.
Thank you, Donald.
Thank you very much.
239-1070 is the number. Next, we go to Fort Wayne. Chuck is on the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson.
Hi, Chuck.
Yeah, hi. Donald, your story about George Snyder reminds me of a story about Billy Boat. This is in the IRL days, and Billy Boat was driving for A.J. Foyt.
Yep, 2000 was the year.
Yeah, and they were having trouble getting into the race.
Mm-hmm.
And then so A.J. Foyt put him in a car, and I think you can, maybe you can confirm this, puts him in a car, and they go back and they get a new car. And I think Billy Boat qualified for the Indianapolis 500 in a race car that never once turned a lap on a racetrack.
Well, I don't know about ever turned a lap on a racetrack, but not here. It was held as a backup car, and it made his it came out for the first time to turn its first laps as a qualification attempt with Billy Boat, and the year was 2000. Yeah, you're absolutely right. That car had never turned a lap during the month until it went out to make the qualifying attempt, and it was successful in getting in. We thank you for the call. Unless you had a follow-up. Did you have a follow-up?
Well, I just wonder if AJ ever told him that this car never drove a lap here.
Oh, I don't know. I think I was telling a story the other night, and I don't know if this one was on the air. I told it somewhere about Snyder in 1988. He decided that he wasn't going to do the last minute bonsais anymore. And I remember being in the garage area on the Sunday morning, and we heard Stan Fox, go to A.J. Foyt's garage. And we thought, well, what's all that about? Well, it was because Snyder had been entrusted with the V6 Chevy, and which normally would barely hold together for qualifying. Sometimes it would make it, sometimes it wouldn't, but it was usually coming apart when it took the checkered flag. And Snyder decided, I just don't want to drive it anymore. And so they had Stan Fox drive it. And I saw George Snyder, and I think it was in Simpson's suite, and I said, are you serious? He said, no, I'm not doing it anymore. He said, I'd like to run here again, but I want to come and have several days of practice. There's none of this last-minute thing for me. And then, of course, sure enough, Stan Fox did two laps, but there's a little bit more to that story. That's not the year he crashed, by the way. But anyway, that was Snyder's... That's the last time he was ever assigned to a car.
Thank you, Chuck. There have been an awful lot of guys over the years that have put in minimum laps. Just last year, I think Bruno Junqueira had about four, five, six tops before he made the race. So it has happened over the years. Do we know if anybody else has? How many? I'm going to guess there have been some that have not taken a practice lap before they qualified.
Oh, several have.
We're talking double digits.
In the roadster days, I mean, Hurtubise qualified a car in 62. He'd been through two cars, and then all of a sudden it looked like, God, I'm not going to make the race. So he went running up and down the line, and Chuck Wyant in a Jim Robbins car, they were going to make a run, but he hadn't really got up to speed, and so the owner decided, let's put Hurtubise in it. So Hurtubise went out to qualify, having never driven that car. But the other night, I think we were talking about Rich Vogler. He'd struggled in 1989 for the whole month, and then at the last minute, and why they didn't do this earlier, I have no idea, there was a connection with the Machinist Union, and Kevin Cogan was driving for the Machinist Union that year, and he had a backup car, which they then turned over to Vogler to see what he could do with the thing, and he went out, and he never turned a hot lap. He came back in and said, put it in qualifying line, and they said, what? You haven't done a hot lap yet? And he had run it down the backstretch and gone through turn three hard enough that he knew it would stick, and he didn't see any sense in wearing the thing out, so he just said, put it in line, and I thought, boy, that wasn't even a hot lap, that was a hot turn, and Vogler knew it would make the show, which it did.
All right, Mark in Speedway is up next. We have open lines at 239-1070. Hello, Mark, you're on Talk of Gasoline Alley.
Hey, gentlemen, thank you for taking my call. Donald passed the White House, heard an interesting story from you, last year about Kenny Moran taking you to the White House, and as I drove by, I thought I'd call.
About me going to the White House?
Yeah, about your first time at the White House.
I've never been to the White House.
No, the White House on 16th Street.
Oh, the White Front.
The White Front, yes.
The White House.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, that's in Washington, D.C.
He said, I just drove by.
Oh, no. Okay, no. The White Front is the bar on 16th Street. Oh, yeah. No, I went there. Yes.
Yeah.
A little easier
correct,
to get in.
Correct. Growing up on the west side my whole life and heard something this past Easter I need your help with. My great uncle, Walt Myers, was a chief observer.
Yes.
For USAC for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think he was hurt in 73 or 4 on the first day the track opened.
That's right. It was 74.
Mm-hmm. 74, yeah. I was in first grade and remember that. But I didn't realize until this past Easter that he was a riding mechanic. Do you know if he was a riding mechanic in the race?
Yes, he
practice?
Was. No, in the race, he rode with Maury Rose in 1934 when Rose finished second driving for Leon DeRay. And Walt Myers was the riding mechanic, and I'm not sure if he rode in any other year, but he's absolutely documented as the second place finishing riding mechanic in 34. 74 was the year that you're talking about where he got hit. They had opened the track to there was the battle to be first on the track for the month of May, and Tom Bigelow was racing with somebody, and I can't
Mike
remember.
Hiss?
Was it Mike Hiss? I think it might have been, and they both were struggling to get out, and they came down, you know, virtually side by side, and he couldn't get out of the way in time. But yeah, no, I knew him. I knew him very well. He used to come into the USAC office, and then his son Wally actually sold me a car. In fact, at Hoosier Chrysler or was it Hoosier Chrysler Plymouth on Lafayette Road?
I believe so. That's Uncle Wally. Yeah.
I traded in a 63 Chevy Biscayne for a 67 Plymouth Fury. It's the and I'll show you how cheap I am. It's the only new car I ever bought.
Still?
Yeah.
Well, hey, it's a very small world. I appreciate the info. Didn't know until this Easter. My old uncle works at the fire department at the 500 and mentioned when we were talking about Uncle Walt that he was a riding mechanic and had no idea. But, you know, I'm a neighbor of yours. I live about 15 doors down.
No, I did not know that. I'll tell you something else about him. He was also a chief mechanic, and the one that sticks out in my mind, because they used to kid him about this all the time, in 1948, Harry McQuinn's last start with the Lynch Motor Special, Walt Myers was the chief mechanic, and it went one lap. And there was a guy named Frankie Bain, used to call him One Lap Myers. And he worked at Allison's, I think, for years, did he not?
Yeah. No, he was. I remember Uncle Walt. He was my great-uncle. Remember him dearly. So, hey, appreciate the time, guys, and have a good evening.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. 239-1070 is our number. More to come. The Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson on 1070 The Fan.
Donald Davidson, celebrating 40 years as the host of the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry. Skilled on principle, union by choice. On 1070, The Fan.
Might be able to sneak in another call. 239-1070 is our telephone number. I'm Kevin Lee with Donald Davidson at a wet Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We'll hope for better weather throughout the rest of the week, most importantly next weekend and 2 weeks from today. And next up joining us is Eric in Vincennes, Indiana. Hi, Eric.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call, gentlemen. Donald, I wanted to ask you about a guy that I just loved his work, and that was Lou Palmer.
Oh.
He only had the 500 for 2 years in terms of being the voice. What happened? And then he was gone.
Oh, well, you had to know Lou, and I admired him so much. I mean, I was in awe of his work, but he operated as an individual. He didn't want to have to he didn't, he was a very private person, and he liked to just come out, set up, do the reports, and go home. And when you're the chief announcer for the broadcast, there's so many other things that you're expected to do, make appearances and glad hand people, and he just wanted to do the job.
It'd be similar to a driver that only wants to drive the car. You just can't do that.
Well, so because there was more to the position, and I was rather disappointed in how it worked out, because I enjoyed working with him so much. Indeed, I used to listen to his reports and just chuckle to myself. And then from 1971 until whatever year it was, I know it was 18 years, I was paired with him to do qualifications, and that's about the most rewarding times that I've ever spent. And his delivery was so unique, and I wasn't expecting this call, so I should have probably had a little bit of a rehearsal. But I remember that even if you'd hear him do a newscast, he would say, like, let's do a racetrack thing. He would say, the light is green, the car is red, the helmet is yellow, the hand is in the air, the qualification run has begun. Yep. He one time I remember I was driving around and in the winter, and he said he was doing the news, and he said, "Well, it's snowing outside. They said that it would. Look out the window and know that it is true." and some of my favorite cars, he said, I remember Gordon Smiley was qualifying in 1981, and he said, the final lap, the crew looks towards the fourth turn, calculating speeds. He comes through turn four. Will they throw the yellow? They will not. They say, congratulations, man, you're in. And he did a lot of jazz lingo. And one afternoon, on a qualifying day, and instead of some people, they have the same catchphrases that they use all the time. The practice session was over, and I think maybe there might have been some qualifying runs, or maybe qualifying hadn't started yet, but there was a little downtime. And so he was sort of looking over the field to see what was still to come, and somebody had had an accident the day before. And we didn't know, the extent of the injury. And so the word was that they might be out before the end of the day. And so he said, well, yesterday, 12:34, into the wall, hard. And then he said, the visit to the hospital, examination took place, and it was found that the injury was not as severe as they thought. 'Twas not so wide as a church door, not so deep as a well, nor as wide as a church door, which is out of Romeo and Juliet. And I'm sorry I messed that one up, because it was one of my favorite lines of his, and I was just laughing, and he was sort of smiling in recognition. And it probably, maybe the final thought about him is that he just completely ad-libbed. No, a couple of thoughts. He had this extraordinary booming voice. And the way the master control tower set up was that all of the radio stations were up and down on the timing and scoring level, which on race day would be timing and scoring, but on qualifications you had all these radio stations. And Lou was down at one end, and he would stand up with one foot up on a chair, on one of the stools, and probably wrap a pencil or a pen while he was talking. And the voice just carried down the whole, down the whole area. And you'd see these young fellows that were looking down, either in awe or saying, who on earth is this? And I remember Bob Lamy said one year, he said, came in on Sunday, he said, the voice of Lou Palmer was heard over 17 radio stations yesterday. He was only employed by one. And then the other thing, too, was that when he would record a piece, not only did he completely ad-lib it, but normally you have in mind something that you're going to say, and then if you mess up and then you come back and do the second take, it's very, very similar. Okay, if he would mess up, which wasn't very often, his second take would be something completely different. It was just, the man had an amazing mind, and I just admired him so much.
Good place to finish tonight. I never met Lou Palmer, but as a kid growing up, I was a huge admirer, and now in the business, I've gone back and listened to these tapes, and he's as good as there ever was.
Fantastic.
Rick. His setups to the Victory Lane interview were just fantastic.
The sense of the drama.
I love listening to those. Thank you for the call tonight, Eric. We'll do it again tomorrow night, 8 o'clock, right after Trackside at 7. Thanks to Tyler Smith and Matt Hicks and Dave Heck. For Donald, I'm Kevin. This is 1070 The Fan. Game 1 of the Eastern Conference Finals is next.